Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, a home for people with intellectual disabilities opens its doors and opportunities for crisis prevention. Later in the program, our own Dr. Joe Servin is here to take your house calls and to talk about the latest headlines on the mysterious Havana syndrome. But first, a Jacksonville advocacy organization for people with intellectual disabilities celebrates a new facility, one created especially for those with additional mental health issues. I'm joined now by the ARC Jacksonville president and CEO, Carrie Bates. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Bernadette Moran, member of the ARC Jacksonville board and mom of an ARC client. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And if you have questions about opportunities for people with intellectual disabilities, you can reach out on Facebook, Instagram, or X. You can also call us at 904-549-2937 or email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Bernadette, your daughter Moira isn't here today, but tell us a little bit about her. How old is she? What's she like?
She's wonderful. Moira's 36 years old, and she has Down syndrome. We were in New York for the first 5 years of her life, and she had wonderful therapy, and then moved back. Jacksonville is my home. I moved back here for family, but I've watched Jacksonville grow in its services for those with disabilities. Till today, I would say it's a wonderful place if you have a child. There are very many services, and what the ARC is doing now is a cutting edge on serving people with developmental disabilities.
And you've been a big part of bringing Jacksonville along in terms of your advocacy, your involvement, your own fundraising on some of these projects.
Yes, it's been a pleasure to do, because I think people, as they see what can be done and the wonderful progress that our folks are making, they're very happy to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. And Maura, how old was she when she was diagnosed? Was it something right from birth?
Diagnosis is right at birth.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what kind of challenges has that presented?
Well, finding services has always been, part of that. Now that she's 36, it's employment that is really difficult to access. So that is a big challenge. But as we were going through, the same thing for most parents is education. But for a child with a disability, it's almost every year. You don't find a school and say, oh, this will be through eighth grade. You say every year, well, that's working for this year. What about next year? And that is a huge challenge, and why I think that it's necessary that there are a variety of services available for them, because just like anyone, you need choices. They grow, they change, their needs change as they grow. And we found now with the village and also with the lodge that's coming up that they need sometimes different services because they have now reached a level, an age for independence. And that's the challenge now, and always beating that and making sure she's equipped to be able to handle it.
And Carrie Bates, tell us now, we're talking about a couple of different facilities. They're both run by the ARC Jacksonville. The ARC is part of a national organization, but it's the local affiliate or local branch. But there is an existing facility, until mm-hmm. very recently. It's been around for several years. I think you said it opened in 2016?
Yes.
Yeah. So that is called the Village.
Correct.
And then this new facility that just opened is called the Lodge.
Yes.
Explain to us the difference between those two facilities and what populations they serve.
So the Village came online about 8 years ago, and it serves 121 people who want to live independently, but maybe need a little support, or they really are looking for socialization that you wouldn't get in the greater community. So I always say, just like many of us move into neighborhoods with people like us, whether you're raising young kids, whether you're 55 and up, whatever, it's kind of offers that for people with intellectual differences. So you can have your friends as neighbors, there's activities, and then there's support that really helps set the person up for success. So there's grocery shuttles, there's staff available on site. So if there is some sort of roommate conflict, there's a staff there that can help. So really the goal of the Village is to help people live as independently as possible. And it's an amazing, amazing place to live. It's one of the first in the country. We host people probably monthly from across the country who want to come and duplicate it, really, because of the success. And the wait list is certainly a testament to that. It's been full. Most of the people moved in when it opened, and most of them are still there. So because of that, there is kind of a little bit of a pent-up demand. But one thing we learned through the Village is that oftentimes people that we support can very easily live alone. They have the skills to, you know, take care of themselves, but they may face anxiety or depression or other mental health related issues that really make independent living more of a challenge. Even roommate conflict, for example. And so through that, we started to really look at what are the mental health needs of the people we serve and how can we better meet those needs so that independence is achievable. And that's kind of the idea that the Lodge was born out of, is really offering independence. The actual physical design of the space is set up to maximize independence, but then also having mental health supports kind of pushed in and out, all of the staff there having a little extra training so that they can day in and day out get consistent support to really set them up for success, always with the goal of independence, both the Village and the Lodge. One big difference is the Lodge does have around-the-clock awake staff, so if there is a crisis, someone is there. Also can help with medication support. The Village is really much like any apartment community you'd see in the neighborhood. There, if you drove in there today, you would not be able to tell the difference between it and any other apartment. There are some things embedded in it that make it unique, but you wouldn't actually notice a difference.
And so the Lodge serves this population that has, and you know, like in any population, people have mental health issues, and that's true within the community of people with intellectual differences. But I'm not sure. I mean, this is kind of an emerging understanding that we're all having. So people may not understand the difference between an intellectual disability or difference and a mental health issue. Can you kind of explain?
Yes. And yes, people with intellectual differences have a mental health, a likelihood of developing a mental health diagnosis, just like the rest of us. Perhaps even more so. We know that about a third of the people we support have a co-occurring mental health diagnosis. And this is emerging not because it's new, but really because I think for most of the people we support, any challenge they faced was almost always attributed to their disability. So like Maura, most of the people we support were diagnosed at or near birth. And there is a intellectual delay that comes with that, which may make their coping with different situations more unique than how you or I would cope with it. I'm learning to deal with conflict is different. So I think oftentimes when anxiety or depression presented itself, all of us kind of attributed that to the disability, not thinking, oh, this is a mental health diagnosis that we can treat and really make an impact on to help the person get set up for success. So the disability itself is something they're born with. The mental health diagnosis is something we know there's proven ways that we can improve their life through treating and supporting them or helping them learn to cope with their diagnosis.
We're talking about a new facility that's open to help people with mental health illnesses and intellectual differences. And if you want to join the conversation or you have a family member that is in that circumstance, you can call us at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. Bernadette, when Maura was young, you said she was diagnosed early with Down syndrome, which is not unusual. But at some point, did you start to notice that there were some coexisting mental health issues, or was that difficult, as Carrie says, to kind of discern?
Quite honestly, it really became evident as she moved out on her own. The ARC has a program where we have individuals who go to college at the University of North Florida, and Maura went to that program and also lived in the student housing. And it was then that I began to see, because I think she began to see her own deficits. And then she was also learning our kids don't have the same ability or opportunity to socialize. Like, I'm sure you had a good friend somewhere that you spent the night at their house and you spent all night talking and getting along and whatever. Our kids don't generally have that kind of opportunity because they're not so independent that they get out there. Well, all of a sudden she was faced with that, with other girls who were living. It was four girls living in a four-bedroom apartment. And I began to see then her problems. And I began to also see that she had a depression that was coming about because she had always been, she's very smart, my daughter. She had always been able to do many, if not everything. And suddenly she was faced with not being able to do that, not being able to handle that kind of the level of independence. And so it really kind of started when she went out on her own, let's say.
Mm-hmm. And those differences that she was perceiving may have exacerbated some existing anxieties that she had.
Exactly.
And mm-hmm. And so how long did it take to kind of figure out that that was happening and not, as Carrie says, kind of attribute issues to, you know, her developmental right. differences?
I think I saw that immediately because I was so familiar with her, having lived at home with her for all of that time, that nuances of change I could begin to see, you know, when she would come home. And plus, I've always been fortunate that I have a group of people, friends, as well as individuals that I've met through the ARC that have given me a basis of understanding. And I mean, I think that's critical to any parent to be involved in an organization, because you do have the advantage of the thinking of all of the other parents that are involved in that organization, and it's very helpful. So I think I saw that pretty clearly as it came on, and I know we began seeing a counselor to giving her a place to go and talk about the things that were bothering her that she was doing or not doing, and also with a friendship. That's another thing that's really hard. We all don't realize how hard it is to make a friend, and then once you have one, how do you keep it? You know, how do you have that kind of relationship that builds? So that also was a very difficult part for her and still remains so.
When you were looking for a counselor, was it somebody that had experience providing counsel to someone with an intellectual difference? Or do you just go to kind of a regular counselor and hope that they can interpret and understand?
The latter, but not by choice. I would really want to go to someone who had experience, but I'm going back now, what, probably 10 years, more than 10 years. There are not counselors out there who have experience in dealing with developmental disabilities or differences. And so that makes them have to start from ground zero. And so it makes it harder. So I would love to have found someone that had experience, but unfortunately I didn't, and found people that were willing to learn, to read, to study, to understand better the nuances.
Interesting. Is that still a need in the community that
you
see?
Oh, very much so. Mm-hmm. Very much so, yes.
Is that something that the ARC is in any way looking at or working on in terms of trying to connect families to people, you know, counselors who might have that background?
Yes, and along those lines, one thing we really have started in the last 10 years is taking the student interns through different mental health programs. So hopefully part of our kind of advocacy work.
And the student interns, explain that those are the students at UNF.
UNF or any other university, if they're pursuing a degree in mental health or trying to become a licensed mental health counselor, they can do part of their clinical experience with us, so that down the road, hopefully, there'll be more people practicing that do have some experience and exposure to people with intellectual differences. It's kind of twofold. It allows us to really meet the needs of the people we support in a really affordable way through partnerships with the universities, because many of the people we support are underinsured, or Medicaid is their primary insurance. But also it really does, we're hopefully kind of pumping out a cohort of future professionals that have had this experience in life. And so that if someone like Moira walks into their office a few years from now, they've had that experience and can be better practitioners.
So the Lodge is a relatively small facility. Talk about its design and how it's meant to support people who have some mental health issues, not just with staffing, but kind of how it's built. And also, it isn't huge, right?
Right. So it's six individual apartments. It's 5,500 square feet. It's really a very unique, and I would just say cool design, in that people can live independently. They get their own sitting room, their own kitchenette, to really get the dignity that comes with privacy. There's so much to be said for having your own space, obviously, but then there are still common spaces. So there's a big kitchen where staff can help prepare meals. There's a sitting area, people can socialize, but then plenty of space to kind of retreat to when people just need to be alone. So that's the physical design, I think, is a huge part of supporting this population. And it's six people, it's 24/7, it's staffed 1 to 2 people at all times, depending on who's there and what their needs are. And the goal is to help people gain the skills to live independently. And that could take years. It's not considered a short-term crisis program. It's really a preventative early intervention, help someone develop the skills long-term. We do offer other mental health supports at our programs for people who aren't in this program. So we do a lot of what we call psychosocial rehabilitation, but it's almost a form of a group type therapy, because Bernadette and I were just talking before, really a huge benefit of that program is the daily supports. So a lot of people may see a counselor, you know, every couple weeks or once a week, but you're not going to get that daily reinforcement, that daily feedback. And so the group model allows us to really, for our population specifically, make sure that they're getting the redirection, really problem solving in real time versus trying to reflect later, which can be hard for all of us. So that's a model we use both at the lodge, but then in other programs. So if someone lives at home or they live in another setting, we can still support their mental health needs through that program.
And you mentioned that this is kind of a preventative therapeutic approach. And we, I think all of us, unfortunately, have seen headlines where people with an intellectual disability have gotten into trouble with law enforcement because of a misunderstanding. So what is it about a facility like this in terms of its preventative role that can help with that?
So it's twofold. Again, it helps the person themselves, the person we're supporting, really gain the skills they need to cope with just the challenges we all face. But then there is always an outreach type part to it, where we do try to partner with our local law enforcement, community partners, and do kind of two-sided training of what we know, what they know, so that whenever we have an interaction in the community, that people can know how to respond appropriately. And I would say, I think in Jacksonville, we're pretty fortunate. We do from time to time, for different reasons, sometimes unrelated to us, have interactions with law enforcement. And they are very aware of our work. They're very supportive and I think willing to learn. So I think we've made a lot of progress in that area, but certainly this is a way to continue that conversation. And really opens up more doors for people to ask more questions and understand really the difference.
And so, Bernadette, your daughter is currently kind of in a wait list posture for the lodge. Is that
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so what is your understanding of how long that might take? And why is it that that seems like a suitable move for her at this point?
Well, I have no idea how long it'll take since the lodge has just opened. So we don't know how long each individual will be there, and I don't know how far I am on the list to to move in, so I don't have an estimate on that. But I think, as Carrie mentioned, that consistency is there for counseling, which I think would be very important for her. She lives in her own apartment now, you know, her own one bedroom, so you don't see as much of her, and you don't see as much the issues that she's facing when she's in her apartment, and she does isolate herself to a great extent. So I hope that the people at the lodge will provide that kind of consistency, that, and they will see the nuances of her. As we said with counselors frequently, they don't understand a developmental difference, but the people who will be at the lodge will be tutored in that, and I think will be very effective in understanding and helping her cope with some of the things that prevent her success in a social environment.
We have an email I want you to kind of respond to. Jason, he says, good morning. I have a 13-year-old son with pretty significant intellectual and development disabilities. He has a chromosome deletion, is nonverbal, and needs assistance with basic life skills. He will never be able to live independently. Is there a waiting list for facilities? And then he continues, it's heartbreaking to know that he will eventually need care outside our home. And we put off looking into options. We don't want to face the reality, even though often the child or young adult may be better served consistently by caregivers.
Yes. So what I would say to anyone, especially if you have a child in the age that Jason's talking about, is we have an advocacy department that is available to really have some of those conversations. There are a lot of things that you want to be doing early on because there are a lot of wait lists. That's not to say that it is an endless game, but there are definitely some things you want to get lined up. Many of our residential organizations, ours, others in the community, operate really in contract with the state of Florida through the Agency of Persons with Disabilities. That itself has a wait list to get services through the state. But the sooner you start that, the better. And there are things the people on our advocacy team can really help families understand what matters as far as getting someone off the wait list, things you want to be documenting, things you want to have records of to show that the person's going to be in need and that it is to their benefit. And really, they will achieve more if they receive the services. So I encourage people to reach out to our advocacy department. We're one of the only in the state of Florida that really offers that support to families and really directs people where to go. So I always tell people, if you take nothing else, just know if there's someone in your community, in your church, and you know they need help now or are going to need help in the future, to set up time to talk to someone on our advocacy team to really start that process. And that a lot of times kind of drives the conversation. From there becomes, what are the person's needs? There's all sorts of different homes. We operate outside of the ones we're talking about, five other homes that really have their own unique culture and vibe, depending on what the person's personality is, what their needs are, what their goals are. And so that really becomes a matter of when when the adult is ready to go out on their own, what do they need and how can we help them be successful? But certainly just the advocacy department, there's so much out there that parents, none of us, I mean, I've worked in this field now for almost 10 years, and it's a hard system to navigate. So no one should be expected to do that on their own.
And so even if somebody hasn't kind of registered with the state of Florida for services, they could use your advocacy. And how do they contact someone with that part of your?
So through our website, there's a whole site on advocacy and family supports. And yes, they will help kind of point people in the right direction. And then if they need more support, there's services we offer beyond that. We have case management services that are available. We just started a new guardianship program for people that a lot of times for families were more of a backup guardian for family members. But there's just all sorts of things because it never, when you have an adult child with a disability, that's not the end. I think Bernadette can attest to that. Really, the planning for the next phase never ends. And so really it takes you through that whole lifespan. And that's something I think kind of unique to our team is that we are kind of constantly looking at the lifespan.
I should add that Jason added in his email, thank you for the work that you do assisting our most vulnerable. But Bernadette, talk a little bit about, you know, what is your reaction to an email like that from someone like Jason? That's obviously a very difficult position for a parent who is dreading the thought of their child having to not be at home.
Well, certainly I always feel bad for a parent, and I sit back and say I'm very fortunate with my daughter. For one thing, her physical health has always been very good, and he's dealing with not only, you know, emotional and developmental, but it's also physical disabilities. So for him, it's very difficult. The good thing is, as Carrie mentioned, is the advocacy department, and it has guided me really for 20 years. Has guided me in what I'm doing in the services and knowing everything that's out there, because that is so hard to find out what services exist in the community that you can turn to. And that is something that the advocacy department is good at doing and helping you to understand. And maybe it's even blending, you know, different agencies, you know, to come together to make a better life. It's not, you know, one solution. So really dealing with people who know what they're doing and who are compassionate to you is critical.
And how are you able to plan for the future? I know you said that your daughter has gone through many kind of stages, evolving needs already. How do you look toward her, you know, midlife and her later life and try to work to anticipate what that might look like?
It's hard. It's very hard. But one of the things that has just, it's probably a couple years old again at the ARC, which I have to keep coming back to since I'm so familiar, but they have started a life path program in which you can work to write down what you want for your child for the future, what you think it will take monetarily, what will it take to do that. And the ARC also has a pooled trust that allows you to begin saving for your child and not having that go against that $2,000 threshold that is there for Social Security and Medicaid services. So there's a place to save the money, and then there's a person to help you to figure out how much do you think you need to do and what do you need to do also in terms of guardianship or trustees or, you know, whatever it is that you need. They can help you to understand that and guide your thinking. And that has been, again, very helpful to me because it is a constant worry. And I'll tell you what's happening now is not just parents coming in, but parents who have passed away and their siblings now are coming in saying, OMG, I've just gotten responsibility for my sister and I haven't lived with her for 20 years. I don't know what she's capable. I don't know what to do. And that is a situation you don't want to fall into. You want to make sure that you have informed families, your family members, and that you have something in place to guide them.
And Carrie, how important is kind of bringing family members along? I mean, I would imagine that they're under sometimes, you know, as we heard from Jason, some very difficult circumstances, very, very stressful, I can imagine. So what, if any, resources are you able to direct parents to who are, you know, kind of coping with various challenges like this?
Yes, I think that is significant oftentimes. And that's why we actually kind of call our advocacy department the Advocacy and Family Support Department, because they are going through oftentimes just their own journey and their own trauma. And one thing I know, one of the licensed mental health counselors we're partnering with on the Lodge, we're really starting to talk about some sort of family therapy type family support to support people as they kind of go through each stage. But many of our staff, whether it be in our transition program when someone's transitioning out of high school to college, or now in our aging program that's helping people who are aging, really spend a good bit of their time talking to the family, educating the family, helping them to understand what's going on, and then pairing people up, just like we all benefit. Bernadette talked about having friends that you lean on, having some organic partnerships and relationships evolve for family so they can get to know each other and really understand someone who maybe has gone through something before them, and what they learned is, I think, critical for all of us.
So we've talked about this new facility, the Lodge, for people who've got some mental health issues. There's the Village, which is an apartment complex for people with intellectual differences. And then there's these group homes. There's about five of them. Is that right? Around Jacksonville?
Correct. Yes. What
need is there overall? What kind of waiting list is there overall for these facilities?
So the need, honestly, the need's pretty staggering if you look at the numbers of people in our community and the state. Really, we probably support around 20 to 30% of the people who have some need. Most of our programs, our partners, our peers, most of our programs are all running kind of at or near capacity. The problem is that we face is that everyone really has really unique needs. So we're constantly trying to ask, what is, you know, a need that we can meet in the community. And right now we're talking a lot about aging. We're talking a lot about autism and developing more programs. But there's almost an endless need. There's so much. We just had a meeting last week and one of the board members said there's so much to be done. And there really is so much to be done and so many people that need our support. And finding ways to do that as efficiently and effectively as possible is kind of the challenge that the ARC gladly accepts.
Mm-hmm. And Bernadette, just kind of final thoughts about things that, you know, either your experience has taught you or your work with the ARC has taught you that you think the community would benefit from hearing?
Involvement in a community like the ARC, whether it's the ARC or another one, but I think it's so advantageous to be involved in that organization because you learn so much. They are out talking with our legislators and advocating for services, and if they don't know from families what's important and what families are needing and driving, then you don't get that kind of change. And so I can't say enough the importance of being involved in an organization that serves individuals. And whether it be, I mean, Cerebral Palsy has an organization in town, Spina Bifida has an organization. There's, you know, different places that you can go for the particular disability of your child. But most important to do that.
Well, Bernadette Moran, Carrie Bates, thank you both so much for being here. I appreciate it. It was a good conversation.
Thank you very much for having us.
All right. Up next, House Calls with Dr. Joe. Our own Dr. Joe Servin takes your healthcare questions at 904-549-2937. We also talk about the latest health and investigative headlines about Havana syndrome. Welcome back. I'm joined now by neurologist Dr. Joe Servin, host of our Saturday program, What's Health Got to Do With It?, which is a great listen. If you haven't heard it before, it airs 4 o'clock every Saturday. But Dr. Joe also joins us once a month to answer your healthcare questions. So you can call us now at 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you don't want to use your first or last name, that's fine. Just let us know. So Dr. Joe, welcome.
It is so good to be here with you, Anne, and hopefully not April Fool's Day, right?
Yeah, we've got enough of that all the time. I got plenty of April Fools, but this is a topic I've been dying to talk to you about. Yeah. So Havana syndrome, we'd been planning on talking about this anyway today, But last night, a real bombshell report on 60 Minutes. So this month, researchers at the National Institutes of Health found no evidence of brain injury or any difference at all in people who'd experienced what is known colloquially as Havana syndrome. But we should note that last night, 60 Minutes aired this really interesting piece. We're going to get to that, but catch us up. What is Havana syndrome? What is it? What are researchers looking for?
So Havana syndrome, this is fascinating, is basically a collection of symptoms by workers for the government, typically in foreign outposts, started in Havana, although 60 Minutes corrected us and says that Germany was actually the first slot. And they come down with mysterious ailments from fog, terrible headache after hearing this piercing noise. Then they have difficulty with their balance, their hearing, and they can't function like they once did. And there's a lot of these cases. This is like the Bourne movies come alive, except there are real victims here, and we don't know what it is. And they call it Havana syndrome because that's where a lot of the first set of cases seem to occur, from workers at the American embassy in Havana. But since then, China, I think it was in Latvia, Lithuania, Vietnam, Austria,
and
Russia.
Even in the U.S. On the Ellipse, there's been some reports of people who worked in the official positions there leaving the White House. I mean,
it's incredible. So, you know, one thing I always learn from just years of practice, when people start complaining about stuff, even if you don't find clear evidence, you don't start off with the conclusion that they're wrong. You at least kind of park it and say, you know, let's see what happens over time. But it is a lot of people. And it's fascinating just how far flung the conclusions have been. There was one of those shows where they talk about great mysteries that a sound engineer posited it was actually a unique cricket sound in Cuba, and that this was all psychological. The NIH report, which you're just referencing, they couldn't find evidence of, at least on images and on a couple of blood tests, of big differences. But they also pointed out that they did find that the average time to when they studied these patients to when the injury occurred was on an average 76 days. Mm. So it makes you wonder, you know, could there, I mean, when we don't know what we're dealing with, could there be some weapon that doesn't leave a clean signal, or you have to study them immediately in order to see what happens? But these people are really affected. And there is a fund that was signed into law by President Biden that does have compensation for these people. So,
and they are being compensated.
I know there's a very strict rules that in terms to get that compensation, but it exists, which means that someone believes it in that regard. And of course, last night with the 60 Minutes report, it only added more fuel to the fire, I imagine.
And to be clear, these were incidents that were reported, people who had no knowledge of other people's reports of it. Real disabling pain and, you know, noise, as you say. And in some cases, you know, people reporting that they were kind of feeling it perhaps in their car and then moving forward a little bit and it stopped. So the symptoms were really very specific, very consistent. And, you know, they weren't publicly known when they first started reporting. So it wasn't as if there was sort of a, you know, panic or,
right,
ailment of some kind that was just like a mass hallucination.
Right. And that is the problem, because some people do put that out as a possibility. And I guess anything you have to put out there. But you're right. A lot of these people were, you know, not talking to other people. They were in unique locations. And curiously, all of them seem to be in postings except for foreign postings, except for some of the ones that you've mentioned. But yet a preponderance of government workers, that just makes you wonder what is that? This is one I've been following for years. Actually, many of my colleagues and I and ENT doctors and have all been curious, but something is going on.
Yeah.
And it just makes me a little nervous. I'm wondering, like, well, what weapon could that be? But ultrasound or some sort of type of pulsed sound energy can do things like this. I mean, I don't know what a weapon would look like that would do it, but there are clinical trials now that uses focused ultrasound for surgery. So it's not too out of the realm of the spectrum to kind of flip that on its head. And can you weaponize focused sound? It's all speculation on my part, but there are so many studies and so many conflicting reports. This is when we're just going to keep on watching until we figure out what this is.
We're talking to Dr. Joe Servin, neurologist, and our resident doc from What's Health Got to Do With It. He is here to take your calls and questions. You can give us a call at 904-549-2937. You can also reach out on social media, and you can email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. In terms of the balance between neurological and psychological issues, you know, they're, as you say, one of the questions raised were these people just experiencing something psychosomatic,
right?
Which people very often don't like to hear. They feel like it's dismissive. But are we learning? I mean, we're talking about the same organ here when we talk about neurological issues and psychological issues. How much are we learning about the intersection of those two things and whether they really are two separate disciplines or should be studied more holistically?
I think that's a great point. And I think this is one of those areas that probably should be looked at holistically. When you think about it, the same, it's, as you said, it's literally the same organ. It's just a different type of presentation or problem. So a lot of psychological things, you know, they can have a biological basis, and as such, they can go wrong and create problems that look psychological, if you will. But when you, even if you think some, like a common difficult condition like Alzheimer's, that sits right on that line, because as people lose memory, sometimes they hallucinate, or maybe they have depression on top of it that only makes it worse. And these are conditions that we talk about with a psychiatrist or psychologist is sometimes. So it is something that we probably should be looking at in totality. And as we get newer tools and technologies, we do see that people are starting to kind of at least focus on it in that direction with a big sense of how does this all fit into the larger scheme of things.
Is that something that you think neurology welcomes, or is that something that's difficult to kind of put into that more, you know, hard science field, if you could put it that way?
I think that neurology is welcoming, mostly because things like functional MRI and these newer devices are really kind of now navigating in this realm. Now, would you see a neurologist for a psychological problem? Maybe not. But if there are other symptoms or something going on, it's a fair game to try to figure it out. So I think everyone welcomes it. I think the system is not set up just yet to kind of have it all joined together, but I believe that's something that we'll see over our time, if you will.
We have a question email. Mike emailed. He said, recently my wife called Mayo Clinic. This is specific because he used to work at Mayo,
right?
In Jacksonville for a neurology appointment, and was told that they don't take neurology patients. Do you know why?
Oh boy, I don't want to speak for Mayo Clinic. I think that would be a misunderstanding. That they have like an incredibly they have so many cases, and I can assure you, Mike, that when I was certainly there, they saw all things neurological. That may have been a misstatement or a misunderstanding, but they are very good about trying to accommodate. The issue is there's such few neurologists in the community, and there's so much neurological issues. If you speak to any neurologist, they are so booked out because they only make up almost less than 1% of the medical workforce, yet stroke, dementia, neuropathy, MS, brain tumor, seizures, migraine, headaches, they're all part of that's all in the rubric of what we do. And there's a tiny percentage of us that exist.
Is it possible that that's why he was told that, that maybe there's just not any available neurologists?
I suspect that's the case, but I would say I would give him a try again. I know from there they always do good work and they try to accommodate everyone they can.
They miss you, Dr. Joe. You need to get back in it.
I miss them too. They're wonderful. Yes.
So I want to talk just a little bit about one element of the Savannah syndrome that I think is interesting. This idea, we touched on a little bit of it being a mass psychogenic illness. I mean, I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole, but that's just crazy right. Events, right, that sometimes do happen on a mass scale. Talk about what that is. It's, I think, called a functional neurological disorder.
So functional neurological disorder is one in which there is not, like, if you think of like a stroke, neurons died, and then whatever that controlled, then you can't do it. Like you lose your ability to talk or move. A functional disorder looks like these things that can happen in a stroke or brain tumor, but no tissue has died. Nothing has been hurt. It's more that your brain or your belief or whatever, that you are sick and you're manifesting with the symptoms unconsciously in most cases. You don't realize it, but it's like you're almost been suggested into believing you have symptoms. And that's what a functional disorder is like you have the brain's working, it's fine, but somehow the thoughts have almost overtaken the function. And it can look as though you have something, but the good news, that brain tissue can be brought back.
What can you give us some examples from that have happened of this?
Well,
kind of thing?
One of the most famous that's posited is the Salem witch trials. Individuals who were accused, and when they would talk about I feel the demon and all that stuff, and this is happening, and then someone passing out next to them, and then the next person passes out. That's like a classic historical example. There have been more recent examples where individuals think that someone so-and-so is contagious with something, and next thing you know, they're manifesting
sick
with the symptoms. This is why I always like, you know, when someone is researching things and why med school or nursing school can be dangerous in those early days while you're studying it, you're looking things up. I go, oh, is that me? Could I get that? And you can, if you can kind of almost hallucinate any type of symptom. And this is where it just goes awry, where you're not doing it on purpose, where it's almost unconsciously has taken over. In the Havana syndrome thing, that just seems just so unusual for weird balance issues to kind of come up as a functional condition. But now that we're talking about it, it's now it'd be harder that it's more likely to occur.
We've got an email from Mike, and we've got to do it briefly. Recently, my wife called. Oh, no, I'm sorry. We did that one already. So just really quickly, when we talk about the intersection between belief of something and an actual injury, the door is still open on this research?
Oh, yeah. The door is definitely open because they may need to do different blood tests or to study these people way closer to the time of injury.
Well, Dr. Joe Servin, it's been so nice having you here today. We appreciate it. Thanks for doing your monthly house call.
I love coming here. Thanks so much, Ann.
Yeah, and we'll be back in just a minute with Jacksonville University celebrating 90 years of service.
Baptist Health is a proud supporter of First Coast Connect. Baptist Health, committed to building a healthier community for all of us. More info at 202-4YOU or baptistjacks.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
I'm Scott Tong. An emerging area of medical research uses the qualities of your voice and artificial intelligence to try to diagnose disease.
Usually people that are depressed are going to speak at a slower pace versus somebody that's very excited or anxious will speak at a higher pace.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
The Jacksonville Symphony and WJCT Public Media are pleased to present the Jacksonville Symphony's concert series, Sundays at 7 p.m. Listen to WJCT's Classical 24, 89.9 HD2, or by asking your smart speaker to play Classical 24.
We all hear things differently. That can be tough when there's so much noise. But how do we better listen to each other? I'm Jen White, host of 1A. This election year, we're a space to speak up. We're also committed to the idea of becoming better listeners. That's what 1A is all about, from WAMU and NPR.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. Jacksonville University hosts its annual Charter Day on April 12th to celebrate its 90th birthday. I'm joined now by Jacksonville University's Vice President of Strategic Operations, Scott Bacon. Welcome, Scott.
Ann, thanks so much for having me.
90 years.
90 years, 1934.
We were talking about you're a veteran because you've been there.
I'm in my eighth year now. 2016 was my first year at JU.
You got a ways to go.
Ways to go.
All right. So the university is celebrating its chartering or its founding. Is this year a particularly big one for the school?
It is. It's our 90th birthday. Again, we were founded back in 1934. I'm not sure everybody in Jacksonville knows. We were actually William J. Porter University back in 1934, founded by Judge Porter, which is appropriate now that we have a College of Law. But this is actually our 10th Charter Day. President Koss started the tradition in 2015 of celebrating our birthday. And this is the 10th year that we've had Charter Day and gone out in the community and had a day of service.
And so President Tim Koss created this kind of annual observance. What was the reasoning behind it? And what does the Charter Day mean for students and faculty there?
It's a day for us that's a day of service. And we really want to be a good stewards of the community, of Arlington, of Jacksonville, but also, you know, really teach our students and the Dolphin community that it's a value for us. You know, our values are our leadership, our community, and we want to teach service to our students. And that's what we do that morning. We go out to over 35 sites this year we have signed up, over 18 volunteers between our students, our faculty, our staff, our members of the Dolphin community, members of the Jacksonville community. And so, again, this is year 10. The numbers are getting pretty jaw-dropping now. We have over 30,000 hours combined between those 10 charter days now, 112 organizations that have been a part of it. So it's a fun day for us to come together as a Dolphin family and really help serve the Jacksonville community.
And in terms of, you know, Arlington, I mean, we were just talking about what a beautiful campus it is there. It's in a part of Arlington that's got some challenges. And I think, you know, more recently, the school has been very deliberate about engaging with the Arlington community in a way that maybe earlier it was kind of in, but not of Arlington in quite the same way. Talk about that evolution.
I love that terminology, and that's something that we talk about a lot, is that we have to be of the community of Arlington and ultimately of Jacksonville. And that was a big emphasis for President Koss when he came back in 2012. He's a graduate of Jacksonville University, 1981. And when he came back, he found an Arlington that was different than the one that he left. And that's when he and we really made the commitment to be a part of the revitalization of the Arlington community. First of all, because we see it as our civic duty and as good stewards of the community, as the economic engine of Arlington. But also for us, ultimately, we need to rise together. It helps set our ultimate ceiling. The community of Arlington and Jacksonville University need to ascend together. And so enter the Renew Arlington plan that we partnered with the city of Jacksonville on, the CRA, the Community Redevelopment Plan, and we're seeing a lot of the upgrades now in aesthetics, in safety. The College Park, which was the old Town and Country, has come back right by the Arlington Expressway. And so we're continuing to see that growth and development, and now even more new and exciting ways that we're exploring to continue to develop that idea of a collegiate village, where really us and the community are more interchangeable and one and the same.
And you partnered recently. We spoke to some folks at Scenic Jacksonville who were kind of doing these tours of Arlington to reintroduce people from, you know, the area, from the water, from the streets. But that was something JU was involved in.
Absolutely. And we're having a panel discussion soon that the president is going to take part in. And yeah, a lot of exciting things. We're starting to tease out some of our thinking about how we can not only continue the Community Redevelopment Plan, which is that Merrill Road, Arlington Road, University Boulevard corridor, which has had great success, but how we can continue to think about things we can do on our campus. On the north side, we're developing the Medical Mall, where we'll welcome in the new four-year medical school in partnership with LECOM, which is set to open in 2026. We have Dolphin Point Landing down there. Baptist Primary Care just moved from Merrill Road into the third floor of our health sciences complex. And then on the south side, we have property from University Boulevard all the way down to the St. John's River next to IDEA Charter Public School, who we partnered with during COVID, where we have a lot of ideas on how we can activate that space, not just for us and to provide more amenities for our students, but how we can really catapult the revitalization of Arlington.
Just about 20 seconds. What can people do and expect from this Charter Day?
Well, they should head to ju.edu/charterday and sign up for the event. Again, you mentioned it, April 12th. Over 800 volunteers already. We're going to have Mayor Deegan on campus at noon that day with a proclamation for Charter Day for Jacksonville University. So sign up, be a part of the day. We'd love for people to join in the fun.
Well, Scott Bacon, thank you so much for being here today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
And that's our program. We welcome your feedback or suggestions for future segments, and you can email both to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. This program is rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight, and our entire archive lives at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast platform. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our producer is Stacey Bennett. Kathy Waterman is our associate producer, and our director is Brady Corum. Join us tomorrow when we learn why your DNA could help determine the effectiveness of your prescription drugs. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.